One of the things that you will probably find as you study the book of Daniel, especially prior to getting into the verse-by-verse portion of the study, is that there is a lot of information by way of introducing the book of Daniel, a lot of history that serves as a backdrop to the book of Daniel, and we want to talk about some of that history. The sheets that are being passed around right now should be helpful to you to get somewhat of an overview of the things that we are going to be talking about tonight. Now, from time to time, I'm going to be looking on the computer and looking at different things. You have this chart, do you not? And going around the room now is this chart. Most of you should have that by now. If you don't, you'll notice that this particular chart is just a bird's eye view of a portion of the other chart that you have, that one. This particular chart is looking at the period of the divided kingdom, and I lost it. You'll have to bear with me on some of this. Is a bird's eye view of this portion right in here, carried down through the Babylonian Empire. Can you see my little hand there as it drags along? Now, one of the things that I have learned to do, and again, you'll have to be patient with me as I learn to operate some of this, is I can zoom in on things. So if you can't see something very well, again, be patient with me and I'll try to learn to zoom. I've done it before, but that doesn't always mean I can do it again. But at any rate, what we're going to try to do is to go through tonight some dates and give you a little bit of a history and look at some maps along with that history of what happened in the northern kingdom and then later in the southern kingdom. Of the people of God. Now, if I can get back to where I wanted to be, there we go right there. I want to look at some of these dates and call your attention to these. I mentioned a moment ago that Peggy has with her a notebook, and that would be a good idea. I'm a very big advocate of notebooks. I like this kind for myself because I can open it and I can put things in it. And I can take things out and make copies of them if someone needs something. But I would encourage you to buy a notebook and use it to take notes in our class so that everything doesn't have to be presented on the screen. It doesn't have to be in the form of a handout. It's more like a school class that you would be in to take notes and learn and so forth. And then when we get to the text of Daniel, you can simply jot down at the top of the page chapter 1 and then go verse by verse. In fact, we might go a number of verses at a time as we examine contextual principles and storyline of the book of Daniel. Now, I've asked you to remember some dates, but I want to get some dates before you for landmarks, if you would please. You'll notice that David and Solomon ruled about 1,000 years before the coming of Christ. That was when David sat on the throne over the nation of Israel during the days of the United Kingdom. That would be before the little split that you have on the sheets that were just passed out. And you will also notice that during the days of the divided kingdom, after the days of Rehoboam, when the kingdom divided about 931, I believe it was, B.C., sometime after, we read of Jeroboam II ruling in the northern kingdom of Israel and King Uzziah, that you will recognize as a very good king, in the southern kingdom of Judah. The timeline that we want to place that on is about 800 years before Christ. The next slide that I want you to see is the development of the Assyrian Empire. To the north, Assyria began to creep in, just as God had warned through the prophets Moses and Joshua and others, as we see prophet after prophet after prophet telling them time and again that if you worship and serve idols, here is what's going to happen. You will surely be taken captive. You will surely be enslaved by another people. You will lose your land. Now remember, we've read a number of those. And we noted in Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 1 through verse 10, how that Moses prophesied that there would be a remnant that would be restored to the land. Now, as that remnant would be restored to the land, it was conditioned upon their keeping the covenant, keeping the commandments, statutes, and ordinances, as it is stated, that are written in this book of the law. Remember that? And as they would be written in this book of the law, Moses is telling them that in order for a restoration to take place, it would necessitate them continuing in the law that was given on Mount Sinai. Now, the significance of that to our study is to identify the time of the captivity and then to see a time that was prophesied when they would be released from that captivity, and then to see when they would be restored to their homeland. Now, on this map, you see Assyria coming in to the north and taking the northern 10 tribes. You find them on this map non-existent. They don't exist on this map because the Assyrian Empire, according to the prophecies, had come in and had taken them. Now, Isaiah had warned them imminently about the approach of the Assyrians and the captivity that was so close upon them. And he also told them that a man by the name of Cyrus, the king of the Medes and the Persians, would release them from that period of captivity. Now, there would be some events that would take place in the middle. For example, you see the advancement of the Assyrian Empire. But you'll notice on this map, I hope the color shows up enough that you can see it, the little spot of Judah right here. Now this little spot of Judah represents the period in the history of Israel around 700 or so B.C. when Hezekiah, almost said Uzziah, when Hezekiah was king of the southern kingdom of Judah. Now Hezekiah, you will remember, was a very good king. And it was during this time frame of 2 Kings chapter 18 through chapter 19 that we read of Sennacherib, the king of the Assyrian Empire, sending his ambassage, as it were, with his captain, Rabshakeh, to speak with Hezekiah. Now, if I get these names mispronounced or in the wrong order, you throw up a flag and I'll back up and try to say it again. But Sennacherib sent Rabshakeh to speak with Hezekiah about surrendering because he had conquered all of these other nations. And you can see how important that would be. How would you like to be little Judah on a map like this? And to know that here is an army that has conquered everything in its wake, and now here you are all alone. Well, that was the message of Sennacherib through Rabshakeh to King Hezekiah. And if you can picture the army, as it were, or the inhabitants, I should say, of the city of Jerusalem, sitting on the walls around the city and Rabshakeh making this declaration before the people, in essence, in short abbreviation, saying, you better talk to your king, because surely he is a madman. After all, look at all the peoples that we've conquered, and their gods were not able to deliver them. Who do you think you are that your God will deliver you? Now, looking on this map, you could see the logic behind such an argument, couldn't you? Go talk to Hezekiah. It would be better to surrender and live than it would be to fight and to die. And can someone tell me what Hezekiah said to Rabshakeh to tell Sennacherib? Well, Hezekiah told, just to make it short, Sennacherib, he said, you best just pack up your box of belongings and go home. Now, that's a very loose paraphrase. But he said, you need to go back to Nineveh, where there your sons will kill you. Now, the next morning is the part that I like to the story, because as you turn in your Bible to 2 Kings chapter 19, you'll notice that Hezekiah's threat was very real. Sennacherib's army the next morning woke up to find about 185,000 of them dead. And so Sennacherib, along with Rabshakeh, took their army and they went back to Nineveh, the capital of the Assyrian Empire, where Sennacherib was slain by his sons. Now, what I said all that for is to say this. As long as the people of God were obedient to the commandments of God, then they would live. When they were not obedient to the commandments of God, then they would certainly suffer the consequences just exactly as they had been instructed by Joshua and previously by Moses. Now that's one of the reasons that we wanted to lay that groundwork. Now you don't see on this map Israel anymore. They have forsaken God. I want you to look at the next map. Whoops. The next map. Do you see Judah anywhere on this map? No, you don't see Judah. What do you conclude has happened in the interim? They've been worshiping idols, and they've been taken captive now by the Babylonians. I want to back up a frame. You'll notice in the year 612 B.C., the city of Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, fell. Now, Assyria, as you'll notice here, had been somewhat of a world empire, if you please, for a long time, since the days of Tiglath-Pileser, about 845 B.C. Nabopolassar came to the throne of Babylon and rebelled against the Assyrians. Now, Nabopolassar was the... I have on this chart that Nebuchadnezzar, the son of Nabopolassar. Some have suggested that perhaps Nebuchadnezzar was the grandson of Nabopolassar. But nonetheless, Nebuchadnezzar was the general who led the Babylonian army against the city of Nineveh and defeated it in 612 B.C. Now that is again a very important date that sets itself as a backdrop against our study. In 605, this is a very important date, 605 B.C. was the Battle of Carchemish, establishing the Babylonian domination. And we talked about Pharaoh Necho in our study last time, the Pharaoh of Egypt, who came to fight against the Babylonians at Carchemish. Nebuchadnezzar defeated the Egyptians, in fact chasing them south through Judah. And at Jerusalem, Nebuchadnezzar heard of his father's death and returned to Babylon to sit on the throne of his father as king of the Babylonian Empire. The first group of Jewish captives then were taken captive along with Daniel and his young friends that we want to talk about for just a moment. We're not going to delve into this very deeply at this point because we're going to a little bit later. But if you'll turn to Daniel chapter 1, Daniel chapter 1, and let's notice the first four verses. It says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of God. And he carried them into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. And the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring in certain of the children of Israel, even of the seed royal and of the nobles, youths in whom was no blemish, but well favored and skillful in all wisdom and endued with knowledge and understanding science, and such as had ability to stand in the king's palace, and that he should teach them the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. Now we want to pause there, because here we see four young men. Daniel, and as we sometimes know their names better in the Babylonian language of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, their Hebrew names was Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. See, I did that, Richard. And these four young men, some have presumed their ages to be somewhere perhaps between 12 to 18 years old. They were young, very young men that were very well schooled in a number of things, and in particular here we notice that they were very well schooled in the sciences. I want to notice that in the year 597 B.C. there was a second group that was taken to Babylon. Jehoiachin, Jeconiah, and Coniah, Peggy, as we look at other names by which these men or this king is called, followed the reign of his father Jehoiakim. Now, don't get confused on the names, Jehoiachin and Jehoiakim. I simply want to make an observation about, I prefer to use the name Coniah because it's just simply easier to pronounce. But if you'll turn in your Bible and notice this observation in Jeremiah chapter 22, Jeremiah chapter 22, in verse 24 and the verses following, Jeremiah 22, verse 24 following. It says, "As I live, saith Jehovah, though Coniah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, were a signet upon my right hand, yet would I pluck thee hence, and I would give thee into the hand of them that seek thy life, and into the hand of them of whom thou art afraid, even into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and into the hand of the Chaldeans. And I will cast thee out, and thy mother that bare thee, into another country, where ye were not born, and there shall ye die. But to the land whereunto their soul longeth to return, thither shall they not return. Is this man Coniah a despised broken vessel? Is he a vessel wherein none delighteth? Wherefore are they cast out, he and his seed, and are cast into the land which they know not? O earth, 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 hear the word of Jehovah. Thus saith Jehovah, write ye this man childless, a man that shall not prosper in his days. For no more shall a man of his seed prosper sitting upon the throne of David and ruling in Judah." Now it's said concerning Coniah that he would be taken out of the land of Judah, that he would be taken into a place where he would become a captive and he would not return. And as far as his seed was concerned, he would be written off as childless, that none of his seed would sit upon the throne in Jerusalem anymore and prosper. Now, what does that tell us about Coniah? What was to happen to his lineage? As far as kingship is concerned, his lineage would be cut off. It would be no more. Now, he would not be returning to Judah. His lineage would not be returning to Judah to sit on the throne and reign in Judah. Now, a significant point we want to notice on this particular element is that Coniah, tracing back from Christ, Coniah is in the lineage of Christ. What does that suggest to us about Christ sitting upon the throne, the literal seat, the throne of David in the city of Jerusalem and reigning on earth? Not going to happen. Now, this is just a tangent note that I want to make in the observation of this passage. But this passage speaks of these people being taken into captivity, taken into Babylonian captivity. Now, Coniah, his rule lasted about 3 months when Nebuchadnezzar took him and 10,000 Jews to Babylon. Now, this second group of exiles or captives are included, I should say, the prophet Ezekiel. Now, we've already noted that Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were taken captive in the first siege. But now we find that a second group of captives, including Ezekiel, is now taken into Babylonian exile. In the year 586, this is another important date that we want to try to remember. In the year 586, that marks the fall of the city of Jerusalem when the temple itself was destroyed. A king by the name of Zedekiah, and I get a little irritated just to mention his name because Zedekiah was nothing but a puppet on a string. He was an appointee by the Babylonian kings, and he vacillated back and forth and back and forth, simply doing the will of the Babylonian kings. 11 years later, Jerusalem was totally devastated by the Babylonian forces. We can read about that in 2 Kings chapter 25, verses 1 through 10. And I want to slow down and pause just a little bit so you can write some of that down if indeed you're taking notes. 2 Kings 25, verses 1 through 10. In that chapter of 2 Kings chapter 25, we might note that a third group was taken into Babylonian captivity. Jeremiah was among those who stayed behind in the land. 2 Kings 25, and of course, Jeremiah 39 and 40. Also mention some of these things, and I perhaps am going too fast. I think sometimes when we mention passages of Scripture such as these, it would do us well to pause and simply notice them in passing and at least read from the text. Jeremiah 39, let's look at verse 11. It says, now Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, gave charge concerning Jeremiah to Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, saying, take him and look well to him and do him no harm, but do unto him even as he shall say unto thee. So Nebuzaradan, the captive of the guard, sent, and Nebushasban, I'm going to stumble over some of these names, and I'll drop down to count all the chief officers of the king of Babylon. It tells us that they sent and took Jeremiah out of the court of the guard and committed him unto Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, that he should carry him home, so he dwelt among the people. Point being, Jeremiah was given a place in the land and was not taken among the captives, but he called upon the people of Judah to repent and do the first works, as it were, to return to the old paths in Jeremiah chapter 6, and their attitude was, we will not. In Jeremiah chapter 40, in verses 1 through 6, we see that Jeremiah stayed behind and is eventually set free, as it were. This next chart that I want you to see bridges the gap of time from the time that the captivity began to take place, where Daniel and these others, Ezekiel and others, were taken as captives into the land of Babylon. And it helps us to see that when Babylon was no more, as it was conquered by the Medes and the Persians, and Darius, the king, sat upon the throne, that young Daniel is still a prophet. And he is prophesying in the courts, as it were, of royalty, having been a prophet to King Nebuchadnezzar, and then serving under, at least for a shorter period of time, under Darius, the king of the Medo-Persian Empire. This particular map shows the people of Israel returned from captivity and shows that they have returned to the land just as God had promised it, from the river of Egypt to the river Euphrates, as it were, as they once again inhabit the land. Now, this period of restoration that you see on your map, and I want to, or on your chart, I want to return to that very quickly. You'll notice on this chart the very things that we've just been talking about. And you'll also see the dates that we've been discussing. Now, the dates may vary as much as a year. Don't get excited by that. I think we have mentioned 605 as the dating of the Battle of Carchemish, where the Babylonian Empire essentially was established. Some scholars date that at 606. I prefer to date it at 605, but it does date back just shortly before 605 to take in a part of the previous year. So some scholars use the number 606 to date that. Most, however, use the date 605, and of course from 605 to 536 gets you your 70 years of Babylonian captivity. Here, of course, is the division of the empire when King Solomon died and Rehoboam became the king. And here we have the line of kings through Israel and the prophets that addressed the ones or the northern tribes. You'll also notice, by the way, that Isaiah is one of those prophets. Here's the period of the Assyrian captivity and the Babylonian captivity. And here are the prophets that addressed this period of time. And you'll notice that Jeremiah, Daniel, and Ezekiel are among those prophets. And so we want to study some of those, and that's the purpose of the beginning of this series of studies. But you'll notice that the year 536 here constitutes the return of the children of Israel into the land of Canaan under the reign of Cyrus, the king of the Medo-Persian Empire. I want to call your attention back over here to Isaiah the prophet. And I would encourage someone, if you would please, Chris, would you mind to read this for me, please? Beginning in Isaiah chapter 45, You might back up into chapter 44 a couple of verses and then come on down into chapter 45 and read for me verses 1 and 2, where we see that Isaiah, way back over here, about 750 years before Christ, prophesied concerning the release of the children of Israel under the reign of Cyrus, the king of the Medo-Persian Empire. You have that for me? In those verses, we see that Isaiah names Cyrus. And Cyrus, of course, ascended to the throne of the Medo-Persian Empire a long time after Isaiah prophesied, at a time when the Babylonian kingdom didn't exist, and at a time when the Medo-Persian kingdom didn't exist. And he calls him by name. That's impressive to me, brethren. When you think about the providence of God to express who rules and who does not, we can see that in this Old Testament illustration. That God does, in fact, rule in the kingdoms of men, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. But as we pass from 536 B.C. with the fall of Babylon and the first of the children of Israel returning, we want to look now at another date, if I can get back to where I was. Oh yes, restore what? What was it that would be restored? I want to look at this prophecy from Jeremiah chapter 27. I about forgot about that, that's why I put that on there. Jeremiah 27. Jeremiah 27. I want to begin, well, I probably should begin at about verse 16. It says, "Also I spake to the priest and to all this people, saying, Thus saith Jehovah, hearken not to the words of your prophets that prophesy unto you, saying, Behold, the vessels of Jehovah's house shall now shortly be brought again from Babylon, for they prophesy a lie unto you. Hearken not unto them, serve the king of Babylon, and live. Wherefore, should this city become a desolation? But if they be prophets, and if the word of Jehovah be with them, let them now make intercession unto Jehovah of hosts, that the vessels which are left in the house of Jehovah, and in the house of the king of Judah, and at Jerusalem, not go to Babylon. For thus saith Jehovah of hosts, concerning the pillars, and concerning the sea, and concerning the bases, and concerning the residue of the vessels that are left in this city, which Nebuchadnezzar king of Babylon took not, when he carried away captive Jeconiah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, from Jerusalem to Babylon, and all the nobles of Judah and Jerusalem. Yea, thus saith Jehovah of hosts, the God of Israel, concerning the vessels that are left in the house of Jehovah, and in the house of the king of Judah, and at Jerusalem. They shall be carried to Babylon, and there they shall be until the day that I visit them, saith Jehovah. Then will I bring them up and restore them to this place." Now I want you to notice the last verse there, verse 22, as Jeremiah prophesies concerning a restoration. The vessels that King Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the city of Jerusalem, from the temple itself, we find that these vessels of gold would be brought back. They would be restored, Jeremiah says. And of course, Isaiah had said that that would be under the reign of Cyrus, the king of the Medo-Persian Empire. So what was to be restored? Well, the city of Jerusalem would be restored. The temple would be restored. The people would be restored. And they would be restored under the terms of the commandments, statutes, and ordinances that were issued in the law of Moses on Mount Sinai. Now, I've said a whole lot for a long time. Let me open the floor just for a moment for any questions or comments that someone might have before I go a little further. Going to be exciting, isn't it? Well, this is going to be a good study, I think, and I believe that you will enjoy it. As, yes. We can put this, I think, on the website, I believe, and I want to give some credit to some of these charts as far as the sources of them are concerned. Okay, if we put them on our website, we should probably do that. It's kind of, I was talking with Chris a while ago, when you study material like this, you get some here, some there, and before long it all kind of begins to look alike, so you're not sure exactly where each bit came from, but we'll work on that and make that available, or we can just print them for those who might like to have these dates. Well, some of these dates are more crucial than others. 536 is an important date because it marks the time of the beginning of the restoration period. It's the beginning of the restoration period, and then we begin to see groups being brought back into the land. In fact, I think it was about three different efforts for the restoration to take place completely, and then some still chose to remain in the Medo-Persian Empire because there they had established themselves, they had jobs, they had a host of things that caused them to want to stay. Yes. Yes, it would date that time frame. I want to go to the next slide, and that'll help us a little bit. You've got the second group coming back in about 457 B.C. with Ezra leading that group. And so that somewhat, for the most part, dates the book of Ezra. And, of course, we can take just a moment to turn to Ezra chapter 7. And I don't want to take the time to read all of this, but you can have the material and you can write down the passages and do some studying, I hope, on your own concerning some of this background to prepare you for a verse-by-verse study of the book of Daniel. I think it's essential to place Daniel on the timeline and know what has brought us to that point. That's why I spent so much time on the history of this. But if you'll turn back to Ezra chapter 7, you can read from there on through chapter 8 and get the time frame of Ezra returning with this second group of people. And if you'll notice in the first chapter of the book of Ezra, in fact, in the first verse, it says, it says, now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of Jehovah by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, Jehovah stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and put it also in writing, saying, thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth hath Jehovah, the God of heaven, given me, and he hath charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Now you see what Cyrus is saying. There's going to be a restoration, and God has charged me to build him a house. So I'm going to send you home with the authority to build the house. Now, that helps us, I think, to see the place even of Ezra. He had a position of leadership in the return of the children of Israel to the promised land, as it were, during this period of restoration. Now, there were a lot of things that the book of Ezra represents that will help us, I think, to see what all needed to be restored. When we think of a people in the land of Babylon, who then became the property, as it were, of the Medo-Persians, and now are being released, perhaps we think of a people that have always done right things while they were in captivity. And perhaps we think of a people that really don't need to change anything except just go home and build the temple. And that really wasn't true. They've been in captivity for 70 years in the Babylonian captivity. Others who were taken captive from the north were in captivity for longer than that, from 722 B.C. to 536. John, do the math on that for us if you want to. But it tells us that there were a number of years that had passed that these people have been in captivity. And because they've been in captivity for quite some time, what is it that they've forgotten? The law. That's right. They've forgotten the law. And what was it, one of the things at least, that took them into captivity? Well, not obeying the law, and in particular the practice of idolatry. And in particular the practice of marrying women that they ought not to have married. And so there are a lot of things that they have to correct. Yes. We can read of, you did good. You want me to read that? I got you. 2 Kings 17. Translations are nice, I tell you. 2 Kings 17:33. 2 Kings 17:33. Oh yes, it says, they feared Jehovah and served their own gods after the manner of the nations from among whom they had been carried away. That's right. They're worshiping other gods, practicing idolatry. And of course, what have we noticed is a typical practice of idolatry, fornication, and other types of what we will label as moral transgressions of the law of God. And if you'll notice in Ezra, the 9th and the 10th chapters, there is a great deal of confession of sin and prayer on behalf of these people. And if you'll notice in particular in the 10th chapter, the demands of repentance are such that they must put away their foreign wives. They must cease these practices that they have cultivated through these years. Now, that helps us, I think, to see the place of Ezra. And then we want to talk about a third group that returns to the city of Jerusalem in 444 B.C. Now, keep in mind that prophets, and let me get back to this previous timeline chart, this one, the prophets Haggai and Zechariah and Malachi and Ezra and Nehemiah, and of course Zerubbabel, we don't have a book called Zerubbabel, but an important character during this period of time in leading some of these people in their return. What we want to notice is that Haggai led in the rebuilding of the temple in the city of Jerusalem. And during the time frame of about 520 to 516, and by the way, you notice that we're counting backwards. Was that your question? We're counting backwards. And the reason we're counting backwards is we're in B.C. times. And then we get to Christ and we start counting forward. But what we want to notice about Haggai is that his work was to primarily lead the people in the rebuilding of the temple in the city of Jerusalem. Now you remember that as we read from Jeremiah, in this restoration, it would involve the vessels that Nebuchadnezzar had taken being placed back in the temple. Now when Haggai returned to help the people to build the temple, they had become indifferent about building the temple. And you will remember, and if you'll hang with me just a moment, on the first chapter of the book of Haggai, the question is asked of the people why they have become so indifferent about building the temple. The prophet says, consider your ways. You work, you labor, but you put your money into a bag as if it had holes in it. You don't have anything. Sound familiar? Well, why? Consider your ways. You build your own sealed houses, while at the same time, You've allowed the house of the Lord to lie waste. Now, why do you do that? Now, that's the question or the proposition that Haggai begins with, to help these people to see that what they're doing is displeasing to the Lord, and they've just got to stop and think about their ways, that what they're doing is just simply unacceptable. Now, Nehemiah, in the year 444, returns, and what is his primary work? His primary work was to rebuild the walls around the city of Jerusalem, 444 B.C., to rebuild the walls around the city of Jerusalem. And once the walls were built, and once the temple had been built, then it becomes necessary, in order for a restoration to take place according to the law, to read the law. Now, if you'll turn over in your Bibles to Nehemiah, the 8th chapter. Nehemiah, the 8th chapter. You'll notice in verse 1, it says, "And all the people gathered themselves together as one man into the broad place that was before the water gate, and they spake unto Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the law of Moses, which Jehovah had commanded to Israel. And Ezra the priest brought the law before the assembly, both men and women, and all that could hear with understanding, upon the first day of the seventh month. And he read therein before the broad place that was before the water gate from early morning until midday, in the presence of the men and the women, and of those that could understand, and the ears of all the people were attentive unto the book of the law. And Ezra the scribe stood upon a pulpit of wood." I want to drop down to verse 5. "That Ezra opened the book in the sight of all the people, for he was above all the people. And when he opened it, all the people stood up." Now you'll notice another list of names down in verse 7, concluding with the Levites, "and they caused the people to understand the law. And the people stood in their place, and they read in the book of the law of God distinctly, and gave the sense so that they understood the meaning." Now what is it that the priests are doing? When the law is read, what are the priests doing? They're explaining it. Here's what it means. Here's what you need to understand from this. And so the people learn again a lot of things that they're doing that are wrong. And in the 9th chapter of the book of Nehemiah, much like the 9th chapter of the book of Ezra, the people confess their sins. But then it becomes time to populate the city. How do we know who's going to live in the city and who's not? You see, a restoration is taking place, and they get out the books of the genealogies and determine who is in fact a priest, who is not in fact a priest, who may officiate in the temple, who may live inside of the walls of the city. And so that determination was made by selecting one out of every 10 to live inside the city walls of Jerusalem, according to the books of the genealogies. Now, there was something else that I wanted to talk with you about tonight before we run out of time, which I'm about to do. Oh, yes. Thank you. The third remnant returning. Oh, yes. Here's where I want to be. Is that Daniel lived during this time frame from 605 until about 534 B.C. So you see that he spanned a good bit of this time period. He was from among the first group of captives taken into Babylon. He continued there the entire 70 years of captivity, and then on into the reign of Darius somewhat, where this decree, or Cyrus, where this decree for freedom was made. Now, what becomes the theme of the book? How much time are you telling me I got left? A good 4 minutes, huh? The theme of the book. When you're studying from the book of Daniel, one of the things that stands out is that God rules in the kingdoms of men. As we contemplate that, I want to make some application of it, in your minds at least, to controversy and political environments that might even exist today. And I remember back just a few years ago when the year 2000 occurred, there were folks who were wanting me to preach a sermon on Y2K. They thought, well, the end is coming because it's the year 2000. And so when folks begin to think that way, then it becomes important for us to recall some of the things that we learned from books like Daniel. Then in 2001, when the Twin Towers fell, folks were excited, thinking, well, the end is surely coming, and the end of our nation is surely coming. Well, God has not promised that any nation will stand forever. He has promised, however, that the kingdom of God will stand forever. And so we want to see that God rules in the kingdoms of men. And there's not anything, not any power, that's any greater than God. And in the book of Daniel, if you'll turn to the second chapter of the book of Daniel, we're going to spend a good bit of time there, but not tonight. In Daniel, the second chapter, in verse 21, it says, "And he changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that have understanding. He revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth with him. I thank thee and praise thee, O thou God of my fathers, who hath given me wisdom and might and hast now made known unto me what we desired of thee, for thou didst make known unto us the king's matter." God rules in the kingdoms of men. In the fourth chapter, time and time again, you'll notice that statements are made that help us to see that God rules in the kingdoms of men. Now, in this great book, we see the rule of God is manifest during the days of King Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, Darius, and Cyrus, kings of the Babylonians and the Medes and the Persians, foretold to occur in the days of the Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans. We're going to study somewhat extensively things that pertain to these kingdoms of men. And Daniel is discussing the sequence of kingdoms, especially as he gets over into the last six chapters of this book. Now, in this book, we learn the rule of God would be especially manifest, number one, with the establishment of God's kingdom, and number two, with the vindication of the cause of His saints in chapter 7, and actually on through the remainder of that book. Now, a brief outline of the book. Brief outline of the book. Did you just copy all of this so everybody has this? Good. Good. That's fine. In Daniel, the first chapter through chapter 6, we see God's providence in history. I want you to be impressed with the providence of God. We'll study that at some length, but in the first chapter, we see Daniel and his determination not to be defiled with the king's dainties. He's not going to be like the Babylonians. In the second chapter, we see Nebuchadnezzar's dream and Daniel's promotion and the interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. We see in the third chapter, Daniel's friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who are literally tried by fire. And then in the fourth chapter, we see Nebuchadnezzar's second dream and temporary insanity to the extent that he does learn that God rules in the kingdoms of men. And then during the reign of Belshazzar, we see the hand that appears in the handwriting on the wall. And of course, the famous expression that we remember from that is that thou art weighed in the balances and found wanting. We'll talk more about that next time. And then in chapter 6, we see that Darius makes a decree that results in Daniel's being cast into the den of lions. And we'll stop there, and you have the rest of this material from chapter 7 through chapter 12. We'll talk about that some more next Wednesday evening. Any questions or comments? Yes. The northern kingdom and the southern kingdom constituted the people of God, yes.
So they both constituted the people of God.
Yes, but the northern kingdom was taken captive first.
Okay. And it showed they dropped back down when, I guess, the Babylonians took everything at their
hands. That's right.
So, and it just went off the bottom line.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, that's right. You've got it.